Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. We call it bull, baloney, BS for short. Whatever the name, there's a lot of it around. In American politics, in business, in life, our guest tonight says that when bull is everywhere, so is a threat to truth. And that, he says, is changing America's relationship with reality. Tonight on Point, wading into the mire, a philosopher's take on BS and the fate of truth in America. But first tonight, we go to Washington, where just hours ago, the House of Representatives passed a bill to sharply limit the scope and reach of class action lawsuits. The Senate approved the measure last week, and President Bush, as part of his strong push for tort reform, may sign the bill as soon as tomorrow. Joining us now from Capitol Hill with the latest on the legislation is John Harris, national political reporter for The Washington Post. John, thanks for being with us tonight.
Yeah, good evening, Tom.
So what is the hope here? Who pushed for this and why?
This has been something that has been long sought by the major Washington business lobbies, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. It's been something that's been long sought by President Bush, who, as you point out, is a big backer of tort reform, going back to his days as governor of Texas, and perhaps even beyond that. I think it's his interest in this is informed in part by his previous experience as a businessman himself. Has long felt that trial lawyers were out of control. They were filing frivolous suits and that they needed to be restrained. And this is the first big package in what's a much broader agenda he has for changing tort reform.
And this step is about class action lawsuits. Give us some examples of some class action suits that we might know from headlines of years past that might have been handled differently or would be under this law.
Well, sure. Among the most celebrated are the class action suits that people have filed against tobacco companies, saying that they were injured by the effects of cigarette smoking. Some of the big tobacco cases are class action lawsuits. And a lot of these are filed in state courts. And under the new legislation, which President Bush will sign tomorrow morning, 11:45, most of these will be funneled into the federal courts. And the federal courts historically are for a variety of reasons, are much less sympathetic venues to class action suits.
So does this mean the end of the kind of super class action suits we've seen in the past? No more multi-billion dollar, rewards, that kind of thing?
We don't know for sure exactly how this bill is going to play out in the real world. I think more likely, it doesn't mean the end of those super big cases, because there will always be attorneys ready to take those, and there will always be plaintiffs willing to wage those cases. What I think it does mean the end of is a smaller and less celebrated kind of case, the ones that don't necessarily usually get big headlines, but they're filed against credit card companies who've been shown to be bilking consumers by putting on extra fees and so forth. Insurance companies have been successfully sued in class action suits for some of their policies. It just makes it much harder to file those cases, because the federal courts simply are, for a variety of procedural reasons, are much less willing to hear those. The proponents of the bill say what it will also do is get rid of the practice of forum shopping. There are certain state courts, local courts in under the state court system, that are notorious for being sympathetic to these class action lawsuits. One of them is Madison County, Illinois, where President Bush traveled last month.
Right.
For this.
Record settlements there. Among those opposing this legislation, of course, they failed in their opposition, but civil rights organizations and state prosecutors. Why would state prosecutors be opposed to this new legislation?
Well, state attorneys general are opposed because they often join in the class action suits. As far as criminal prosecutors, I don't I don't know.
Maybe state's attorney is really where it's at, because they felt more leverage in the state courts.
Right, this is a matter of civil law, so not a matter of criminal prosecution in any way.
And I see here 50 Democrats joining in voting for this. Are Democratic congressmen feeling the heat from their constituents to get behind President Bush on this tort reform push?
I don't know if they're feeling heat from constituents, because I don't actually think this is the kind of issue that engages sort of ordinary voters at any intense level. They certainly are feeling pressure, no doubt, from business lobbyists. Enormous amounts of money went into to pushing this bill. A lot of Democrats were sympathetic to the arguments, clearly were looking for an issue in which they could be on the same side as business.
And so it's through, and more to come. John Harris, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, sure thing. Good night.
John Harris, national political reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from Washington. You can read his story later tonight at WashingtonPost.com. George Orwell, master of clear, cutting, and direct speech, famously wrote that political language is designed to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind. And right now, says our guest tonight, that wind is blowing hard. The country, he says, is up to its eyeballs in BS, baloney, bull. Americans hunger to cut through it. Politicians claim to be straight talkers. The media says it's smart to the spin. But BS is everywhere. It is, says internationally renowned Princeton philosopher Harry Frankfurt, one of the most salient features of American culture, of the American conversation. And BS, he says, is a greater threat to truth than lies are. Bull and the bull artist are indifferent, he says, to truth, to reality. And that, says Harry Frankfurt, is no joke. Tonight on Point, BS, bull, and the fate of truth in America. You can join the conversation. How do you define BS? Do you think you know it when you hear it? Are you sure? Are we drowning in bull? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Harry Frankfurt, Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at Princeton University. He's author of many books, including Necessity, Volition, and Love, and the Importance of What We Care About. His new book, and I'm afraid I'll have to abbreviate the title on air and ask that you do too, is On BS. Professor Frankfurt, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
So, Harry Frankfurt, you say it's one of the most salient features of our culture. Where do you look for evidence?
Well, it's all around us. It's very difficult to avoid finding evidence of it. The most prominent locations, I suppose, are advertising, public relations, politics, any venue in which people are trying to promote a person or a candidate or a program or a policy or a product. There you will find a proliferation of BS.
We think of BS as almost mundane these days, and yet here you are, a very highly placed philosopher, wading in here. Why did this catch your eye? Why is this of interest to a philosopher?
Well, I wrote the essay in question about 20 years ago, and to tell the truth, I don't actually remember specifically what led me to write it. But
so you're not going to BS me about that.
No, I'll try to avoid that. But I've always been concerned about the truth and about the value of truth and the importance of truth and about the importance of accepting the discipline of submitting to the truth and trying to avoid uncertainty and falsehood as much as possible. And the kind of philosophical tradition in which I was raised, the analytical tradition, is devoted largely to clarifying concepts and trying to make our thoughts and our speech more precise and less obscure, less cloudy. And it seemed to me that since it does seem that BS is a very salient feature of our characteristic, it was worthwhile to try to understand better just what it is, what we mean when we talk about it, and what we have in mind when we refer to it. This might help us to get a grip on what's going on and to understand better the kind of situation that our culture is in.
And we know that BS is not truth, but you go further. You say it's corrosive to truth. It's a threat to truth. How so?
Well, what I had in mind there is that the person who is engaged in BS is, as I understand it, at any rate, indifferent to the difference between truth and falsity. He's motivated by a completely different ambition or criterion. He's interested in promoting whatever it is that he's interested in promoting. And the question of whether what he has to say in order to do that promote, to accomplish that promotion, the question of whether what he has to say in order to achieve his goal is true or false is more or less irrelevant to him. So he will say whatever he feels it will be useful for him to say without regard to whether it's true or false. And in this way, it seems to me, BS is even a more insidious enemy of the truth than lies are. The liar believes that he knows what's true and prefers, for reasons of his own, to say what's false. But at least he recognizes the difference between truth and falsity and the importance of the difference. So there is a kind of a respect for the truth implicit in lying that is absent in BS. And for that reason, I felt that BS was a more, as I put it, more insidious enemy of the truth than lies are.
And
it undermines our respect for the truth. It corrodes our conviction or our commitment to the importance of truth.
And Jack Beatty, there's kind of the bottom line. Marinate long enough in enough BS and you may even lose an understanding of the difference between that and truth.
Yes, but it's a form of wind, really, or vapor, as the professor defines it, of no more significance than an exhalation. That is to say, when someone goes, ugh, you don't say, well, what object is that adequate to? What is that trying to express? It's rather about their inner feeling. It's a matter of, ugh. And so with speech. You know, in some ways, I think the opposite of BS is silence. And I'm thinking particularly of a comment a friend of mine who knew the late Richard Hofstadter said. He said, even Dick's silences were profitable. And I thought, well, what does that mean? And he said, well, it meant that Dick didn't talk beyond his knowledge.
And yet we've got people doing that everywhere all the time these days. We're waiting in here tonight, and it is deep. Harry Frankfurt is with us, Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at Princeton University. His new book is On BS. We're talking about baloney, BS in the American conversation, and how it corrupts our understanding of truth. You can join us. Is BS swamping the boat of truth in American culture? What's the difference between BS and a lie? And can you see how BS has no dependence on facts or truth? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about baloney, BS in the American conversation and how it corrupts our understanding of the truth. My guest tonight is Harry Frankfurt. He's Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at Princeton. His new book is On BS. You can join the conversation tonight. Is it high time a philosopher waded in to explain what's going on with bull and have political and commercial spin divorced Americans from truth, from trust, even from the taste for truth? I guess this, is there more BS now than 30 years ago? Or was it ever thus? Was it always with us as it is today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Harry Frankfurt, I wish you'd define BS for us. How do you do it?
Well, let's see. Essentially, the definition that I have advanced or tried to recommend is that BS is characterized essentially by an indifference to the distinction between true and false, that the person who is engaged in producing this BS is submitted to a discipline other than the discipline of truth. His discipline is defined by the goals or the program that he's attempting to promote, and his choice of what to say is determined by what will be useful in the promotion of in his attempt to achieve that goal, and not by any particular concern with whether what he has to say is true or false.
So facts, truth, reality don't really matter here. You say that most people are rather confident of their ability to recognize BS and to avoid being taken in by it, so it doesn't arouse much concern.
Yes, one of the questions that I'm still puzzled by is that we seems, at least so far as I can see, we seem to have a much more benign attitude towards BS than we have towards lying, for example. The liar is regarded as a bad person. What he does is almost criminal.
It must be punished often.
It must be punished, that's right. Whereas BS, we accept, we're tolerant of it. We may turn away from it with an irritated shrug, but we don't react to it with the same kind of vehemence and intensity and anger that lies frequently evoke. And I don't really understand just why that is. why we should be so much more accepting and permissive with respect to BS than we are with respect to lying.
But you say because there's not so much deliberate concern, and I wonder if that's the same today as it was 20 years ago. We'll come to that. But you say because of that, we don't have a clear understanding of why there's so much BS or what function it serves. I wish you'd pick those two up. Why do you think there's so much of it, and what function does it serve?
Well, it's fairly easy to answer the first part of your question, I think. The reason why there's so much of it is because there are various institutions, practices, and customs in our society that encourage and, in fact, almost require the production of BS. Whenever a person is required or whenever he's in a situation where he feels he must speak about something about which he doesn't really know very much, what he says is practically bound to be BS, remembering your quotation about Richard Hofstadter, or your other guest quotation about from Richard concerning Richard Hofstadter.
Yes.
He didn't speak beyond what he knew.
Mm-hmm.
But people are constantly being put into positions of being required to speak beyond what they knew. This is certainly true in politics, on TV, on radio, and in advertising. So,
but that describes people as kind of victims of the media age or the public stage. But surely BS is not always something forced on people. It's often willingly generated.
No, I think that's absolutely true, and we do seem to have a natural propensity to produce this, to engage in the production of BS. But this natural propensity to do that is, I think, encouraged and facilitated by some of the institutions of society, like the media and our political system.
Now, you also sort of track the course of modern and postmodern thinking, and I feel you kind of putting some blame on, I don't know, postmodernism here, on the idea that truth is itself pliable and undefinable, so maybe BS is just as good. There's no reason to be grounded in fact, in so-called reality.
Well, that's right. If you don't believe that there is such a thing as reality that has a character inherent in it, if you don't believe there are such things as facts, if you don't believe there is a real distinction between the true and the false, then what have you got? If you're going to talk at all, you're going to be speaking in ways that consist in the production of BS.
And this is where it got really interesting for me. You say in that kind of postmodern mindset where people have stopped looking for facts, for reality, for external truth, they look to a kind of a gut check about whether how they sincerely respond to a notion.
Yeah.
In fact, sincerity is put forward as a kind of a substitute for truth or reality.
Yes, I think that has happened, and that insofar as people have given up or abandoned the conviction that there is such a thing as truth to which they are obliged to be submissive, instead of being true to the nature of things, they turn to the alternative of being true to themselves. And as you suggest, sincerity becomes the criterion of correct speech rather than truth-telling.
And as a philosopher, how do you see, to thine own self be true, how do you see that as a basis for understanding the world?
Well, I don't think it's even a basis for understanding ourselves. I don't think that there's much more evidence for there being real facts about ourselves than there is for there being real facts about the world. We are notoriously difficult to understand, and it's notoriously difficult for people to understand themselves. So the idea of there being a truth about ourselves, which is easier to come by than truth about the outside world, seems to me to be rather a foolish idea.
Jack Beatty, here's a lot of a philosophical perspective to chew on. Help us bring it under the real world. On the one hand, we've got vast engines of BS creation now that are self-acknowledged as such, exploiting maybe this kind of unmooring of people's sense of reality from external facts. So what's going on, Jack? Are we being deliberately exploited? Are we marching happily into a world of BS because it's more comfortable? We don't have to know facts?
Well, you know, I think there is some of that. Joseph Wood Crouch once called it permissive exploitation, that we permit ourselves to
come
be
on, exploit me.
Go ahead, do it again.
BS me.
and it's partly the arts of persuasion. I think in some ways, people appreciate BS as they do a tall tale. It's a form of rhetoric. It's a way of selling somebody. And I think that even as someone is making us the recipient of BS, we sort of appreciate it. We say, oh, that was, you've really
well,
done
that's
something
right. We talk
there.
About BS artist, and the use of the term artist there already reflects a certain appreciation of the activity and a respect for it and a an assumption that it requires a certain talent that we admire.
Yes, that's right.
So, and you hold it up. You say lying is a craft. BSing is an art.
That's right, yeah. I think there's something in that. And I'd like to mention also that one of the main concerns of Socrates, great Greek philosopher in the 5th century B.C., or 5th century B.C., was that philosophy should be understood to be the great enemy and hopefully the preferred alternative to what he referred to as rhetoric, where the goal of rhetoric was to persuade people by any means that were available so far as speech was concerned, by saying whatever would be helpful in persuading them, whereas philosophy was an attempt to get at the truth, not to convince people that what you were saying was correct, but to demonstrate that it was correct by providing evidence and argument and rigorous deductions that made the acceptance of the conclusion a matter of rational inevitability.
But Jack, if we live in this media era where people are constantly having microphones shoved in their face, they have to say something, and so they deliver bull, or the organs of the media are used to distribute bull in massive quantities all the time. If we're marinated in it, if it begins to unhinge us from reality, what happens to democracy? What happens to policymaking?
Well, I think it just, we are coded in it, and I think that it makes us cynical about any kind of public communication. And a candidate may say something that's accurate, but people say, well, that's just spin, or that's just politics. When in fact, the statement may well be veridical. It may be actually an accurate statement. But I noticed this last fall looking at focus groups on C-SPAN, that when a candidate would say something, even when it would be something that the person before they saw the candidate's ad would say, well, yeah, I want candidates to speak about health care. When the candidate would speak about health care, they'd say, oh, no, he's just saying that to get elected. That's just spin. In other words, the candidate had just said what they wanted a candidate to say,
right,
but that was just spin.
Immediately discounted. Everything turns into spin.
Yeah.
I mean, the other side of this, I wonder, Harry Frankfurt, if you've thought about, is the relationship between, and I mean this respectfully, but if we withdraw from truth or reality-based decision making, is there a connection between bull and a rise in belief? If the points of fact are pulled away as significant, as weighty, is belief all we have left?
Well, if by belief you mean simply opinions that are accepted impulsively, then I guess that is more or less what we have left. If we're not going to be grounding our beliefs in or our opinions in facts and in evidence and in rational argument, then the only alternative is to accept beliefs on the basis of how they seem to us, how we feel about them, and that will lead us inevitably into the immersion in BS. I'd like to say one thing, though,
yes,
that we haven't really broached because it's something that interests me, and I have very little to offer by way of explaining it, and maybe our discussion will lead to some illumination.
Yes.
The fact that there is so much of this and that it has been so persistent and so as well as so prevalent suggests that it serves some useful function in society. Nothing lasts that long and is so widespread that doesn't have some useful role. So I'm led to wonder what the useful role of BS is that accounts for its success, that accounts for its ability to survive and to flourish in our society, and in fact, in almost all societies.
I wonder if it may be related to maybe it's a lubricant for shifting our understanding of reality. I'm looking here at an excerpt from a New York Times Magazine piece that Ron Suskind had out last fall. Mm-hmm. He's talking to an aide in the Bush administration, and the Bush aide says to Ron, he says, you're part of what we call the reality-based community, people who believe that solutions emerge from your judicious study of discernible reality. And Ron Suskind nods and murmurs something about Enlightenment principles and empiricism. The Bush aide cuts him off and says, that's not the way the world really works anymore. We are an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. And while you're studying that reality, judiciously as you will act again, creating other new realities which you can study too. And that's how things will sort out. So Bull may have a function. It's certainly picked up and embraced almost like a tool.
Yeah.
We've got a million callers who want to join this conversation, okay. Dr. Frankfurt. Let me begin to invite them in. Michael's calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. After seeing Fahrenheit 9-1-1, I thought, well, that appears to be mostly true, and it's been marinated in just enough BS that a population grown increasingly to be cute about it, Toro Coprophile, might enjoy the flavor. The question is whether people will accept something without at least a small flavor of BS. On the other hand, if I get that cynical, and if people generally get that cynical and expect only BS, then at that point they start to judge who does it best rather than long for something else.
So what's your sense? I mean, when you do your own gut check, Michael, your appetite for bull versus truth, if you're really honest with yourself, you know, how much global truth do you want today? How much bull do you want coating it?
I believe that I want none, but I'm sure a lot of people believe that. So I don't know if I should trust that idea. I think that generally, as far as belief goes, when people feel that they're in contact with an absolute truth with a capital T, mm-hmm. then they don't really have to care so much about minor inconsequential facts that are sort of like accidental properties that don't really have anything to do with the real nature of things as far as they can see them.
Michael, that's terrific. Harry Frankfurt, yes.
I think that there's some evidence that I'd rate that a large number of people are simply starved for the truth and are find it tremendously refreshing and liberating when somebody comes along who does not engage in BS. We've seen that recently in the political realm with a couple of individuals who I think came across, mm. whether rightly or wrongly, mm-hmm. as truth tellers. I'm thinking of Senator McCain during
yes.
the primary campaign a few years ago.
And it can feel like pure oxygen, so welcome, as you say.
Right. And there have been a few others who have had more or less successful or unsuccessful political careers, but who created a tremendous sense of liberation and refreshment by giving the impression, at least, that they were not going to engage in BS, that they were going to tell the truth as they saw it. And if they made mistakes, they were honest mistakes and did not reflect an attempt on their part to manipulate opinion.
So, Jack, that suggests that a surfeit of BS may create a huge opportunity. But on the other hand, you know, you have another image of people sitting around kind of smoking BS like opium, and they don't want the doors of the den opened.
Especially, as Michael reminds us, because it is a kind of sugarcoating. But I agree with Professor Frank. There is an appetite for this. An example that comes to mind with me is Robert Kennedy. We didn't see much of him, but when he was campaigning in Indiana, he went to the medical school. And he was talking about all his plans for medical care and so on, and the nurses were applauding him, and the hospital workers were applauding him, and the medical students were sitting on their hands.
Right.
And one doctor raised his hand, and he says, "Where are you going to get the money for all this, Senator? This is pie in the sky." And Kennedy pointed at him and said, "I'm going to get it from you."
Oh, well, there. Hang on to your wallet. Let's get another call. Alan is calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I read the article early this week, and I was fascinated. Back in the 70s, I attended Princeton, and in the architecture studio, one of my colleagues was Princeton's Queen Noor, who was then Lisa Hallaby.
Yes.
Recall a conversation on a related topic, kind of the inverse of what your main point is, that when the term BS is used so freely because people expect much of what they hear to be so, then they're unable to detect sincerity or honest opinion when they see it, because there's such an expectation that most of what they're going to hear that purports to be truth is probably going to be tinted by BS.
So they're discounting what they hear before it even really hits the brain.
And this reminds me of something that I heard, I think it was from Gerber from the Annenberg Center, talking about the mean world syndrome.
Mean world syndrome.
Some advertisers are deliberately trying to perpetuate this idea among the population, possibly to divide and conquer them, because if they can't detect sincerity among each other, then they can't organize around sincere efforts to improve anything.
So you get a kind of a more pliable populace. Alan, thanks for the call. Harry Frankfurt, how do you see it? More pliable? A kind of inoculation against truth or the appetite for truth?
I think that is that does happen, and that's part of the reason why I regard BS is such an insidious enemy of the respect for the truth. I think we do become inured to it and accustomed to it, and thereby more accepting of it, and perhaps even more welcoming of it. so that we not only are tolerant of it, but that we want it, and that we're impatient with people who are trying carefully and conscientiously to distinguish between the truth and the falsity of what they're saying, or what's being said. They want somebody to talk colorfully and make things easy and explain to them just what they're supposed to think.
So every truth teller suddenly sounds like a crank, Jack.
Exactly. What? He sounds like a tedious pedant.
Oh, boy. Great.
The coin has been so corrupted that people just protect themselves against even incipient belief by discounting that person can't be speaking the truth.
Well, we've got a kind of bull session going on here, but but it's on purpose, and I think it's casting some light on where we stand right now. Professor Frankfurt, stand by. We're talking tonight about bull, baloney, BS in the American conversation and how it corrupts our understanding of truth. You can join that conversation. Is BS swamping the boat of truth in American culture? Is one person's BS another's received truth? And how can a democracy advantage truth over BS? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about bull, baloney, BS, and how it corrupts our understanding of truth. My guest tonight is Harry Frankfurt, professor emeritus of philosophy at Princeton University, author of the new book, or newly published anyway, On BS. Fill in the blanks, if you will. He says, BS is a greater enemy of truth than lies are. Why? Because he says BS is essentially indifference to how things really are. You can join the conversation tonight. What's the BS that drives you crazy? And how do we cut through the bull? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Fred is calling from Derry, New Hampshire. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Hello. Excellent show. And I mean that.
Thanks, Fred. No BS. We got it.
Well, two quick points. One is, yes, the weapons of mass destruction thing, how big unreported story of last year was that none were found, and yet, you know, freedom was fought for. It's like there's so much with the Bush administration that's just out of touch with the truth, and that does color our political landscape.
But how does that thrive, Fred? Do we live in a culture of untruth?
I think there's a backing away of untruth, a fear of it. What does that mean as far as having to think we were wrong about something or people? It's not just with the ignorance isn't about intelligence. There's people who are have a lot of expendable income. Another big point I want to make real quick is the alternative medicine crowd. People who spend a lot of money on herbs and things that are anecdotally based as opposed to empirically proven.
So are we becoming deliberate mystics of a kind, Fred?
Yeah, there's a lot of no-think, a lot of distrust of science and embracing of very questionable quackery, really.
Very questionable quackery. That might be another way of saying BS. Fred, thanks very much for your call. Let's get another call here. Gabe is calling from Boston. Hi, Gabe. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say I think that the widespread acceptance of BS by Americans in particular reflects a growing kind of anti-intellectualism in our culture where people have become very afraid within academia, within virtually all spheres of life, to name things as they are and to make serious judgments about something being better than another.
Gabe, may I ask you, do you think intellectuals are less vulnerable to BS?
Not at all. I think that certainly within the academia, there is a fear of sounding elitist all of a sudden for one to say, this book is better than this book, or this string quartet by Beethoven is a greater work of civilization than this pop song by the Beatles or something. There's all of a sudden a great fear of offending people and seeming elitist by calling things traditionally what they have always been. Now that everything seems to be up for grabs, I think that has extended into the very sphere of the truth.
Gabe, we've got to let us pick that up with Harry Frankfurt. Harry Frankfurt, does that resonate with you? Anti-intellectualism in the thriving of BS? Is there a connection to your mind?
I think there's a great deal in what the caller has been saying. I don't know if it's anti-intellectualism exactly, because I don't think it requires much intellectuality to resist or to see through BS. But it is a kind of intellectual slovenliness that is prepared to accept things without critical examination, without requiring serious evidence and argumentation and rigorous thought. So I think there is, I don't know if it's growing, but there is a very widespread resistance to appearing to be superior and to having a judgment that is worthy of more serious respect and attention than those of others. You know, the phenomenon of political correctness has a great deal to do with this. I'm not sure whether it's elitism, because I think that it's not so much a fear of being, of seeming to be or regarding oneself as elite. I haven't noticed that any particular fear of that, at least among the faculty in the academic world. But there is a fear of appearing to be politically incorrect. And that, I think, leads to a great deal of BS and to a great deal of avoidance of respect for, concern for, and dedication to the truth.
Mm.
Let me say
one
more thing that has come up a couple of times, but we haven't actually developed.
Mm-hmm.
There is, it seems to me, although I hesitate to say this because I don't like it, but I think it's true. There seems to be a kind of paradox in the whole idea of democratic society. Because the whole idea of democratic society rests upon the expectation that the public is in a position to make reasonable and appropriate judgments concerning matters of public concern. At the same time, and for the very same reason, democratic societies are given to the production of enormous quantities of BS, because for the very reason that the public has power and that the opinions of the public will make a great deal of political difference, those who are concerned about politics have a tremendously have a tremendous motive for manipulating public opinion and for trying to get people to believe what they want them to believe.
But that sounds like elitism busting right in through the front door. I mean, isn't the idea of democracy supposed to be that there's a sort of a common wisdom, a common urge toward the truth in the general population that protects against BS?
Well, there is that, but there are also conflicting forces. So there's a kind of a war going on between the inclination and the yearning that you refer to for the truth, and the motivation of others to manipulate opinion and to see to it that people will believe what they want them to believe, so that they will vote the way they want them to vote. I think that democratic societies, and it's not only democracy in our sense, but any society in which the opinions of the public are important, and that's true even of totalitarian societies, at least of certain totalitarian societies, where
yeah.
the government can't really function adequately if the people don't believe in it and aren't prepared to accept it. So public opinion is important in societies of all kinds, and to the extent that public opinion is important, there will be strong motivation to try to mold public opinion, to say whatever is necessary to say in order to achieve that molding.
And Jack, I wonder then if the media marinade of BS pulls the general population even further away from a kind of, you know, demand for the truth, if that doesn't open up a new opportunity for politicians who are willing to kind of, you know, really put the pedal to the metal on the BS, I mean, sort of get us into a new sphere of political BS.
Well, some might argue that we've entered it and that, you know, in a way that ideology, which is playing a larger and larger role in politics and certainly in policy, is a form of BS to the 10th power. It's a form of speech that really is indifferent to the facts or realities, and that aims at a kind of internal consistency, and that aims at persuading people and more having power over them. And in this way, I do think that we are in a new age of sort of new frontier here.
Mm-hmm.
Pragmatism seems to be out. in many sectors of our public life, whereas ideology in, and I do think ideology is, as I say, BS dignified.
Well, and plus, once you've got all the modern organs of the media at your disposal, whatever BS you launch, you can pound it into millions of heads in no time at all. That would have been a much more laborious undertaking years past. Justin's calling from New York City. Hi, Justin. You're on the air.
Hi there. I just want to say I'm so happy you guys are having this show. I can never go out to a bar and convince people to talk to me about epistemology. So,
but here we are. We're here for you, Justin.
I have kind of a comment about this that I really see the relevance of this playing out most specifically in kind of the resurgence of the argument around evolution versus creationism. And what's interesting to me is that lots of the arguments against evolution are, well, this is just a theory, and there are a number of competing theories. The thing that seems to me that's kind of BS about that and that's disingenuous about that argument is I understand evolution as a theory the same way, say, photosynthesis is a scientific theory. It's just a theory that has a lot of backing up to it. But you don't see anyone putting stickers in books about photosynthesis as a problem.
Right.
So I think, I think that issue about what's truth and what can we determine as truth, it goes beyond this idea of something theoretical into a really relevant conversation today.
About science and where it stands. Justin, thanks so much for your call. Harry Frankfurt, it makes me wonder, if we could turn back the hands of time and find ourselves in the Middle Ages, before there was real scientific understanding, was everything BS? I mean, do we only isolate and identify BS now because we're supposed to have a standard of science to hold things up against?
Well, I don't really know what things were like in the Middle Ages, but I do know that there were at least some people in the Middle Ages who were very concerned about getting things right. They didn't do it by the methods of empirical science, but they did it by the methods of rational discourse and investigation and conceptual analysis. And they were certainly not at all tolerant of what we would regard as BS or what could at that time be identified as such. So I think that respect for the truth was probably, I don't know how widespread it was, but there were certainly many individuals in the Middle Ages who did have enormous respect for the truth and were trying as hard as they could by whatever methods they were familiar with to distinguish between the true and the false and to avoid just saying whatever came into their minds.
And here we are in 2005. Jack, soaked in BS, maybe we're hearing tonight hooked on BS, but we know in our hearts we better keep a big attachment to truth going somehow. It matters in the end.
Yes, and reality can rush in and just upend our attachment to BS, which often is flattering and full of illusions and bunkum. And, as Michael earlier caller said, it's a sweetener. Reality can suddenly be very unsweet, and all our systems of BS and our platitudes, or as someone recently called it, the bathosphere we live in, all of that will just, as it did on September 11th, and suddenly there we were up against brute, terrible reality.
With the big hello. Harry Frankfurt, we're so grateful to you, the great philosopher, stepping down to write about BS. Thank you so much for doing it and for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you.
Harry Frankfurt, professor emeritus of philosophy at Princeton University. His book is On BS, Fill in the Blanks. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, a look back at the father of the polio vaccine, Jonas Salk. This is On Point. Fifty years after the first mass polio vaccinations, it's hard to imagine the terror that disease once brought American families. Polio crippled more than 400,000 children in the first half of the 20th century. In 1955, Pittsburgh doctor Jonas Salk started vaccinating children against polio and became a national hero. His vaccine virtually wiped polio out of existence in America. This year, the 50th anniversary of Salk's great achievement, the World Health Organization has set its sights on eradicating the disease worldwide. In this radio diary, Jeffrey Kluger, author of the new book Splendid Solution, Jonas Salk and the Conquest of Polio, takes us into one of the great medical minds of the 20th century.
Salk was born at a very auspicious time in history. He was born in 1914 in New York City. In 1916, the great polio plague of that summer came along. And in 1918, when he was just 4 years old, the flu pandemic came along. By the time Salk was 41 years old, he had developed or co-developed the first vaccine against both. Salk used his experience with the flu vaccine to help him develop the polio vaccine. And one of the things he brought to that was a bit of medical unorthodoxy. It had always been the received wisdom in the medical world that the only way to develop a vaccine against a virus-based disease was to use a weakened but living virus. A killed virus was considered a little bit like trying to get a hound to hunt a dead fox. It might nose around at it, but it's not really going to mount an aggressive attack. Salk preferred to use a killed virus, particularly with polio, because he insisted a killed vaccine could be developed, and he was determined to prove it could be. And one of the things that convinced him it could be was that he had made it work with a flu vaccine. He had an almost prescient clarity when he saw something that made scientific sense to him. Salk liked to say that there was a reason he chose to live in the country, even though he always worked in cities. He always commuted into the city from the country. And the reason he did that was that he saw all of the patterns of nature and medicine sort of recapitulated at different scales. And the more he could surround himself with the rhythms and processes of his garden and of the woods and of the natural world around him when he was at home, the more he could recognize those patterns when they were writ small in a test tube. And I think that gave him a true insight into the processes of nature. And when he knew something was going to work, it almost never didn't work. The level of detail that went into his work, when I went through the lab notebooks and saw just page after page of incomprehensible glyphs for testing a single kidney on a single mouse, for a single toxicity parameter, for a single emulsifying agent in the vaccine, and realized that test was about as far from having a real vaccine as laying the first brick of a skyscraper is from having the skyscraper completed. But just as with a skyscraper, it's an act of pointillism, the work he did. It was brush dot by brush dot by brush dot until he had achieved what he wanted to achieve. And that level of tenacity and doggedness is what really impressed me about him. If anything drew him to polio emotionally, I think it was simply the nature of the disease. Any disease that selectively attacks children, that cripples them before it kills them, and even if it leaves them alive, leaves them permanently disabled, that's just asking to be beaten. That's just asking to be stomped on. And I think that's one of the reasons that even though polio had a relatively low case count, 50,000 kids is a horrifying figure until you realize that 50 million were killed worldwide by the influenza pandemic, until you realize that 100,000 a month today die of malaria. Polio seems like a bit player compared to those numbers. But there was a visceral reaction people had to a virus that would kill a child. And I think that's what made polio's days numbered. Salk, after the polio vaccine was approved, he wanted to continue his work, and he did continue his work. He spent the years immediately after the vaccine working on funding for and launching the Salk Institute. While there, he worked on multiple sclerosis. Later in his career, he worked on developing an AIDS vaccine, which always seemed rather touching to me, particularly considering the demographic, because the target population for HIV in the late 80s was the same as the target population for polio in the 50s. And it seemed like he protected this generation once, and then he came along at the end of his career and toward the end of his life and was willing to try to protect them again. Obviously, as we know with AIDS, it's a harder nut to crack, but he advanced the ball a little bit.
Jeffrey Kluger, author of the new book, Splendid Solution, Jonas Salk and the Conquest of Polio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.